Great. So thanks to the organizers. This is a nice workshop. I like the pace of this workshop. Great to have time for discussions. So this is a bit of a strange talk. I haven't spoken about this subject before, so it's kind of a grab bag of things that have come up in previous research of mine that relate to the movability of the cut. And towards the end, I'm going to try to draw some conclusions for foil theories. There's going to be some connections to what Thomas Galley was talking about in his talk. But it's all currently sort of still work in progress. There's some speculative ideas in there. I'm not certain about these things, so do challenge me on some ideas, and hopefully we can come to a new understanding. Good. So here's what I'm going to mean by motility of the cut. So I'm going to introduce something called the principle of cut motility. And the idea is that if you have a physical theory that purports to have universal applicability to all systems, then nonetheless describing some experimental phenomena typically involves making a cut between, on the one hand, the systems that you're going to model explicitly within your theory as dynamical degrees of freedom, and these are the systems that are sort of the objects of your interventions. Like you might be preparing these systems, or measuring these systems, or transforming these systems. And on the other hand, the systems that make up the devices that are implementing these interventions, right? So those systems often are not treated as dynamic degrees of freedom that you're modeling explicitly. And I'm going to say that a theory of this sort satisfies the principle of cut motility if the predictions of that theory are independent of where you put the cut. So if you say, oh, actually, this part of my device, I'm going to start modeling that explicitly, and I'm going to move the cut over to this new point, the predictions don't change. Okay, that's the idea. If you have a physical theory that's supposed to have universal applicability, you can take any part of your measurement device and model that, because it's supposed to have universal applicability, and your measurement device is nothing special. It's made of atoms, too. So I can take any subset that I like and model those. And the idea is just that it should be independent. The predictions you make should be independent of where you put that cut. So what motivation can you give for this? Well, it seems to me, given the discussion that I just articulated, where you put the cut is really just a conventional choice. It's typically determined by convenience. So maybe for the particular problem you're working on, treating something as an external potential is just fine, and you don't need to go and treat it as a dynamical degree of freedom because maybe there's very little back action. So typically, it's just physicist intuition that determines where the cut is, and it's determined by pragmatic ideas of what you're trying to do. So it might be chosen for convenience, but it really has no fundamental physical significance. But as I'm going to try to convince you, this idea still has a lot of power to resolve conceptual confusions and to see things that are you might not have seen before. And that's kind of surprising. If there's a sense in which it's a very trivial thing that, you know, this conventional choice I make shouldn't influence the predictions. Yes, of course it should not. That's much like saying, oh, your choice of coordinate system should not influence your predictions. Yes, of course. And yet, you know, there are other examples in physics. So many people think that Einstein's principle of general covariance ought to be thought of as just the physics doesn't depend on the coordinate choice. And yet, that principle nonetheless has a lot of power for clarifying conceptual confusions. So I think the principle of cut motility is of that sort. Here's a couple of quotes. So one by Heisenberg. So this is sometimes known as the Heisenberg cut or the von Neumann cut in the context of quantum theory. So Heisenberg said, the dividing line between the system to be observed and the measuring apparatus signifies no discontinuity of the physical process. It's the same physics. But there must, within limits, exist complete freedom in choosing the position of the dividing line. Von Neumann's discussion of it in his textbook focuses on measurement devices, but also on the observer themselves. And so he calls it psychophysical parallelism. He says that principle is violated so long as it is not shown that the boundary between the observed system and the observer can be displaced arbitrarily in the sense that he describes, that you can sort of move it anywhere you like. So it's a familiar idea in quantum theory. But in quantum theory, because there's a lot of discussion about, you know, do observers have special status, there's sort of this question mark over whether this is really valid. But in more conventional context where we're not even talking about observers, but just measurement devices, I think it's unobjectionable. So, and I think if you're a materialist, in the case of observers, it's unobjectionable as well. But let me pause here and ask, is there anybody who disputes this as a good principle? To my mind, it seems to be very obvious as a principle that it's, you know, essentially just the physics shouldn't depend on the conventional choices you make as a physicist for how to model it. So I just want to pause and see if everybody shares my intuition about that or not.
Just yep. A question. So does it make sense to talk about a well-defined theory if it doesn't satisfy the principle but doesn't give you a receipt of how to choose the cut? So you just develop a theory. If that's the word to be used, then it's just not well-defined how to use it.
True.
Is it even necessary to even have a well-defined theory in some sense, or a usable theory?
I think it's fair to say that anybody who wanted to deny this would have to, it would be, the onus would be on them to say, for example, you know, here's where you ought to put the cut. Or maybe they would want to say, actually, it's universality of the physical theory that fails, and there's some systems that aren't modeled by this theory, and it's the transition that is where the cut has to go, or something like that. Yeah?
Your principle doesn't seem to say anything about, like, putting the cut too far down, like collapsing something that you're later going to interfere in quantum theory.
Say it again, collapsing something that you're later going to interfere. Well, I think it does presume that you're modeling the external intervention correctly. So if my external intervention is just, I'm going to apply a magnetic field as this atom goes through my interferometer, then were I to model that as a collapse process, I would just be mistaken in my modeling of that external intervention. So I have to do it right. But all it's saying is that whether I model it as just an effective unitary on the atom, or if I take that magnetic field, assign it dynamical degrees of freedom, let the field interact with the particle, you know, and compute it that way, it's not going to make a difference. Yeah.
So the objective collapse model, the objective collapse, would they satisfy that? Or would you say, well, they somehow have like an intrinsic cut, which is like after a certain scale?
No, objective collapse models, I would say, are highly motivated by this principle. They're motivated to do better than standard textbook interpretations, which have an unprofessional vagueness about where collapses occur. And they say, no, we have a new universal theory. Every particle in the universe collapses once every billion years with no exception. And thereby, we preserve this principle. You know, I don't have to know that this is a measurement apparatus to figure out what the dynamics of that system is going to be.
The theory that would not be satisfying this principle, it would have such interventions that, or like implementations of interventions that by themselves couldn't be object of interventions. Yeah, like in the sense that, like, here the statement is that, like, the moving of the cut means that something that we have previously considered to be like the item that we kind of not observe, let's say, like quantum mechanics or something, like not measure, but like just do the measurement with, yeah, like we can subject it to the,
yes,
the next step. Yeah, so
yes, that's right.
Sort of like, so the thing is that, like, it's basically about like non, like the preserving of, I mean, the theory that would not have it, yeah, it would be the theory that like doesn't satisfy it. It would be a theory in which like there are objects that are not.
No, it's not that. The way you would fail it is not by saying, I can't, you know, intervene on this thing. It would just be that the predictions that the theory makes would depend on where you put the cut.
Okay.
You're going to see some examples of this.
Okay.
So the first. What's that?
Sorry, one more question. It's the opposite of Matt's question. Isn't it the problem that if you put the cut too high, there are some questions that don't make sense to be asked anymore? So when you say you make the same predictions.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I don't know, prediction about the probability of a measurement in a system, but now if I move the cut above whoever is measuring the system, then it does not make sense to make this question anymore. So therefore, it's weird for me to say anything.
Well, if you can't make, if there's a place where you put the cut and you say, oh, my physical theory can't make predictions all of a sudden, I would say that's another way your physical theory fails to satisfy cut motility. You know, so failing to make any predictions at a particular level is a way of disagreeing with the well-defined predictions at another level, right? So if the theory just says, oh, I'm sorry, I don't know how to answer the question in that case, then I would say, you don't really have a theory that has universal applicability. Go back to the drawing board, come back when you have a theory that has universal applicability, and then we can check and see whether it makes the same prediction.
I'm not sure it's a good principle, but we can talk later.
Okay.
So then does that mean that for a theory to obey this, it must be valid in all like parameter ranges, for example? So for all energy scales? Or because I can imagine, you know, this like putting the cut somewhere as a change of energy scale, for example.
A cut is usually a cut in quantum mechanics, in the factorization of the Hilbert space, not energy scales. So it's not that kind of cut. It's a cut of in terms of, the von Neumann's example is I measure the temperature directly of the object. Or maybe I consider the thermometer as part of the system, and what I'm measuring is the height of the mercury tube. Or maybe I consider the photons as part of the system, and what I'm measuring is the distribution of the photons, and I'm just moving the cut.
You could put the cut at a level where the at the level of the, so then the way you factorize your Hilbert space means that the Planckian constant is there's this the regime where quantum gravity effects are important, for example, and then maybe quantum mechanics doesn't hold because
why don't we take that up in the discussion period, because we're getting a bit far from my question was just whether anybody really objects to this. and to some extent, so you, does anybody object to this principle? Hey, Rudiger, were you going to object to it, or?
Well, I think I'm going to object to it, but...
Do you want to...
Because it also depends on what you mean by a theory, and if a theory is for instance, in cubism, you would look at quantum mechanics like a tool for an agent to survive in the world. Then, of course, there is a natural cut for every agent.
Mm-hmm.
So it would still be universally applicable because you could apply it to any physical system.
All right, well, good. So let me give you the case for the principle. I'm going to try to explain why it's a good principle, and then you can tell me whether at the end you think it's something you might want to satisfy or not. So I'm going to go through some examples of where this has been applied, I think, with good effect. So it's essentially just a bunch of what I'll call foundational credentials for this principle. So I think it's this principle that ultimately shows us that if you take just the plain vanilla textbook interpretation of quantum theory, it has a measurement problem. So this is how I presented it in my course on quantum foundations. If I look at many textbooks on quantum theory, I find the following sort of set of postulates. One postulate says that the quantum state is a complete representation of the reality of the system. Another tells you how to represent measurements, and it tells you that the probabilities that quantum predicts are objective probabilities, so there's no fact in the past that determines what the outcome is going to be. It tells you that if your system is isolated, it evolves unitarily, which means it's deterministic and continuous. But if you implement a measurement on a system, it evolves according to a different rule, which is the von Neumann-Luders collapse rule, and the state changes discontinuously. So the problem with this is that on the one hand, if you decide that the system is the only thing that you're going to model explicitly and dynamically, and you're going to do it via the collapse postulate, right? So you say, okay, this is a measurement device that's acting on the system. I get a particular outcome. What happens to the state of system? Oh, it evolves indeterministically and discontinuously. But if instead I say, no, I'm going to treat the whole system that I'm going to consider as dynamical as the particle together with the entire apparatus, as long as I include enough stuff in the apparatus, possibly the environment, then the whole thing's isolated. The unitary evolution postulate holds, so I apply it, and I find that because the Schrodinger equation is deterministic and continuous, the whole evolution is deterministic and continuous, and therefore any subsystem of the composite, so the according to representational completeness, the composite state is just the quantum state. It tells you everything about those two systems. It's evolving deterministically and continuously, and therefore any component is also evolving deterministically and continuously because there's nothing more to be said about it. Yes?
So this is because I got confused. And by your answer, you gave to Vitya, if I take this seriously, if I choose the cut in such a way that the theory doesn't give a prediction, then here, I don't even need to go into this unitary business or continuous and non-continuous. I could just say, if I regard the system as a big isolated system,
yep.
then I don't get any probabilistic predictions because I just, it's just unique. It's
well, the
place where I apply the form root, so I don't get a prediction at all, which then, according to
okay.
a bad theory or a bad choice.
That is, you could try to make that criticism of the textbook thing, which is that if I treated everything isolated, then it's not clear what predictions it's making. But maybe a more liberal attitude would be, well, it is, the textbook interpretation at least, is not a purely operational thing. It's not saying simply that the business of quantum mechanics is to predict the outcomes. It's saying things like, oh, there are physical states that are described by quantum states. And so it's making some predictions about what's happening to the composite system. Its physical state is evolving according to the Schrödinger equation. So in a sense, those are predictions. They're not operational predictions, but it's saying that something's happening. And if you ask, is it evolving in a deterministic way? Is it continuous? The answer comes back, yes, it is. And you immediately get a conflict because this other way of modeling it says, no, it's not. And so all I need is...
So somehow this example says that the critical word in the principle is what equivalent means. No, so now we are kind of going to make more explicit what does it mean that there are two equivalent descriptions. No?
Yeah, they I would just mean in the plane they should not logically contradict one another. And I claim that here they're logically contradicting one another.
But if you do a measurement later on the remaining part, then you would have the same probabilistic predictions. No?
Sure. So the fact that there might be some consistencies, like von Neumann pointed that out, doesn't mean that this the textbook interpretation is all fine and good because I found a contradiction. Here is a prediction of the textbook interpretation that depends on where I've put the cut. Is it deterministic evolution or not? That depends on where I've put the cut. That's a problem. It doesn't satisfy the principle. Yes?
Yeah, do you think it's so counterintuitive the fact that, I mean, it's very strange, yes, but the fact that, let's say, when we consider a single system, the evolution deterministic, when we consider the big one becomes so, and then since it's, you say, since this is deterministic and continuous on the whole, then it should also be deterministic and continuous on the parts.
I would say, I would not say it is strange. I would say it is logically incoherent and therefore it should be avoided at all costs because logical incoherence is the worst thing that you can have in your theory. I mean, this is, to my mind, this is a logical contradiction if you assume the principle of cut motility. Now, we're going to talk about ways out of this, so don't, we're not done here. Ravi?
So I was just wondering if the principle as it's stated apply, if you can just, because in your response to Renato's question, you fell back on essentially saying that we're not applying this to some sort of like an operational, to the operational predictions as like an operational theory, but you're reading more into the theory. Like here is the representational completeness of psi, probably. You need to give more reading to the theory than just as an abstract operational theory, like in order to apply this principle. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I guess I have in mind that no matter what kind of theory you're putting forward, so if you're a realist and you say, I'm giving you a theory and I claim that it's describing the reality of the world and how it evolves. Then I say, okay, fine. Those are the predictions of your theory. I'll treat it on its terms. Does the description of reality it provides for one placement of the cut coincide with the description of reality it provides for a different placement of the cut? That will be the grounds by which I evaluate the principle on your theory. If somebody else comes to me and says, I'm a strict operationalist. The only things that matter for me are the predictions. I say, fine. I can evaluate whether you satisfy the principle on those grounds if you like. And so any time you fail to satisfy the principle, that's a problem in my mind.
Okay. So it's agnostic about reading anything more into the operational framework.
Yeah, it's I think it's well defined in both cases. All right.
So
what slide are we on?
There is relativity. For example, you then I could also say, and if I choose one reference framework, the object is not moving, and if the other one is moving, so it's a logical inconsistency. That's
good.
The same argument as here, because here you're comparing different states, and it's not clear, or even different systems. I mean, one talks about the small and the other about the big one, and compare. It's not clear how you would compare them. In the same way as it's not clear how to compare velocities in different reference frames.
Sure.
If I compare it correctly.
Good. Yeah, so maybe this comes down to you know, you do have to understand kind of by the lights of the theory, what equivalent predictions mean. So in relativity theory, we all know that this is not an example of inequivalent predictions, because we know how to translate the description at one level of the cut to the description at the other level of the cut, and we see that they're consistent. And I'm going to give another example of that. And I think, for example, the many worlds interpretation is an attempt to say, although these might seem inconsistent, there's a way of understanding what's going on such that they're not. But the textbook interpretation of quantum theory is not the many worlds interpretation. So I don't think it has the power to say that these are consistent. It's just kind of silent. It just sort of leaves that sitting there and says, yeah, everything's fine. But it needs to say more if it wants to argue for any kind of consistency. Okay. So there's also this inconsistency between, you know, whether this thing has determinate properties like being spin up or spin down, or whether it's just in some big entangled state where the spin property is indeterminate. So that's what you get if you treat it internally, that's what you get if you treat it externally. So I'm not going to linger on this, everybody's seen this before. The point is that once you realize, I think this is the nicest way of presenting the quantum measurement problem, once you realize it, you start seeing that, you know, something's got to give. So for example, you could give up on the representational completeness of psi, then you're doing hidden variables. You could try to give up on, you know, isolated systems evolving unitarily, then you're doing physical collapse models. You could try to say that, for example, this discontinuity and indeterminism is just a subjective illusion. Then you're kind of doing many worlds, and you're trying to salvage the equivalence by sort of adding a story about the way the reality is. Okay, so I think that's cut motility has done a lot for us in the sense that this is the way much of quantum foundations was thought about for a long time. Is, you know, how do you escape it? Fix the textbook axiom. One more thing I can say is that the many worlds interpretation, I think it goes even further and says, oh, let's move the cut to the observer themselves. And I would say cut motility as a principle provides, I think, a strong argument against physical collapse models and for many worlds. Because people who do physical collapse models say things like, if large objects went into superpositions, we would experience strange things. So we must prevent them from going into large superpositions. But when you look at the many worlds analysis, you see, oh, okay, well, let's treat the observer quantum mechanically. We get this big entangled state. And you can ask questions like, if I were to come up to that observer and ask them a question like, do you see something strange? Right? I do the unitary evolution. I find in every branch of the wave function, the observer says, no, I see nothing strange. And you just get them entangled in. And you see that the prediction of the physical collapse people that we would see anything strange is not borne out by an analysis of observers as dynamical systems. So I think it also is a principle that's particularly that's seen use in the many worlds interpretation. But let's move on. Here's another example which relates to reference frames. So there is this long-standing debate about whether coherences between eigenspaces of conserved quantities are fact or fiction. So in 1997, Klaus Molmer wrote a paper saying that optical coherence was a convenient fiction. And I'll just take you briefly through his argument. So, you know, he's a quantum optics person, and essentially the history of quantum optics involves assuming that the light field coming out of a laser is in a coherent state. So this is a coherent superposition of number states of the field. And so in that case, you'd say, all right, that coherence is a fact for such fields. And what Molmer pointed out is that if you take the gain medium, which in many textbooks on quantum optics is treated like a kind of classical system or an external potential, but you instead treat it quantum mechanically, right? So it's not some oscillating classical dipoles, but it's a bunch of atoms. You assume they start out, you know, pumped, and so there's in some population inverted thing. So they're a mixture of energy eigenstates. You apply energy conservation, you find that for example, if a particular atom starts out excited and the field has n photons in it, all that's going to happen is that there's going to be an extra term where the atom is de-excited and I get one extra photon, and the reduced density operator in the photon field is going to be an incoherent mixture of number states. And if you do the full analysis, you find that it's a Lorentzian distribution over number states, so it has exactly the same weights as you have here, but no coherence, right? It's just an incoherent mixture of number states. So Molmer said, therefore, it's not true that lasers are in coherent states. They're in these incoherent mixtures. And so there was this huge debate, people sort of weighing in on both sides, arguing one side or the other. And when you sort of saw the pattern, you realize that this debate has repeated itself many times in the history of physics. So in the context of Bose-Einstein condensation, people found it useful to write down wave functions that involve superpositions of different numbers of atoms, and other people complained and said this is not physical because we have atom number superselection rules. In superconductivity, the BCS ground state involves superpositions of different numbers of Cooper pairs, and people said no because there's a superselection rule for charge, so those things are just fictions. Maybe they help you with your calculations, but they're not real. There's other examples from non-locality of a single photon, superselection rules for charge, baryon number, and it's always the same story. Two sides of the debate. Hey, there's these quantum states, they have coherence, they're useful. Other people saying no, they don't exist. Let's do without them. So here's the resolution I want to propose, and it involves endorsing this principle of cut motility, or thinking about what would happen if you move the cut. And the idea is going to be that quantum states describe the properties of a system relative to some external system. And therefore, whether or not a quantum state has coherences depends on which external system you're comparing it to. And that's going to resolve the puzzle. So let's start simple. Suppose I tell you that I have a spin. It's spin up along the z-axis. What does that mean? It means that there's some other physical system in the universe, like some set of gyroscopes that can define a z-axis, and the spin is up relative to that physical system. So this physical system is acting as a Cartesian frame for the spin. So that's the system that I'm implicitly referring to when I say the spin is up. And it's the same thing with optical phase. If I say something has a well-defined phase, then it means that there's some phase reference that it's well-defined with respect to. So this is the one that's relevant for optical coherence. So one thing you can do, let's go to the spin example, is say, right, I'm just going to write down the quantum state of the spin relative to that Cartesian reference frame, which I'm not going to model explicitly. I'm just going to treat it in the background. It's implicit. I could actually assign it a Hilbert space and talk about the quantum state of the system and that reference frame, which is now some density operator in the larger Hilbert space that includes that. But of course, this density operator, for example, if I talk about its asymmetry properties in space, then the whole density operator for these guys is really being described relative to something else in the background, which is another Cartesian frame, and I'll call it R prime. Yes?
I missed the jump. First, it was like a coherence between different number states of photons, and now it's this, these are like reference
spin
frames.
Yeah.
How are those similar or the same?
So I'm going to come back to the phase one, but in the case where we talk about that, you can think of coherence versus not coherence as, does this thing have any asymmetry under phase shifts? So an incoherent sum of number states, when I do a phase shift on it, it doesn't change. Whereas a coherent sum over number states, if I do an e to the I phi n hat, I pick up a phase factor on those terms and it does change. So only the coherent superposition is sensitive to phase shifts. So it is asymmetric relative to phase shifts, non-invariant under phase shifts. My spin example, we're going to be talking about whether the spin is non-invariant under rotations or invariant under rotations. So the analog here is going to be if I have something that's just mixed over the irreducible representations of the rotation group, that's like being a mixture of number states. That thing is just insensitive to rotations. It's a little bit easier to think about the spin example, which is why I bring it up.
Okay. It just seems like with the number case, isn't it unambiguous of whether you have two different density matrices? I'm sure I'm missing something here, but it seems like it's unambiguous. If I have two different density matrices, one's mixed, one's pure,
yep,
then I can experimentally distinguish them.
Hopefully I can resolve this. I mean, in a longer talk on this topic, I would have gone through,
yep,
why, you know, there's a whole back, like, you've just, you know, kind of told part of the story. Like, we in our paper, we wrote a big dialogue. It was like, step one, oh, can't we just distinguish them experimentally? Oh, okay, let's now see what each position in the dialogue says about that, and you find that it's not that simple, that you know, what, how to even model the experiment is something that they're going to disagree about, the two sides of this argument. So let me not get into it, but I think hopefully I can make the point, even though I'm not going into those details. So the point in this case with the spins is that if you grant that quantum states are describing things relative to some background reference frame, then if somebody says, all right, I'm going to talk about the spin relative to this frame, and so I'm just going to take the reduced density operator in S of this quantum state here. Well, there's no guarantee that this quantum state is going to be the same as that quantum state because they're describing the system relative to different reference frames. They don't have to be the same quantum state. And in particular, if this reference frame is completely uncorrelated with this one, so meaning you have no knowledge of the relative orientation of the two, and so you average over all possible relative rotations of this guy and this guy, then this whole thing is going to be in some rotationally invariant state. When I compute the reduced density operator on here, it's also going to be rotationally invariant. So this is going to be a rotationally symmetric state, whereas this guy here is going to be rotationally asymmetric. He could be spin up relative to this guy. And so they're clearly different quantum states, and they have different symmetry properties. And it's exactly the same thing with the phase. So here's a slightly different example from the one that Molmer gave. But if I imagine preparing my system S relative to some classical charge that's oscillating, and so let's say I even have like a classical electromagnetic field that's oscillating in phase with the charges that set up this field here, then I can interfere them together. I can see something about the relative phase between this system and the reference frame. So it's phase, it is not phase symmetric, it has some phase shift asymmetry. But if instead what I do is I treat that reference field as an internal degree of freedom, so for example, I could have my classical reference phase here, and then everything from this point onwards I treat quantum mechanically, then what we find is that these guys are in some entangled state, and the reduced density operator of the field is indeed an incoherent mixture of number eigenstates, which means it is phase symmetric relative to this common source here. But there's no inconsistency, because when we said this thing has phase asymmetry, it's relative to R, and this guy still has phase asymmetry relative to R, the entangled state is coherent. If I ask about the relative number between these two, I see it is a superposition of a coherent superposition of different relative numbers. It's just that if I compare it back to this guy, that's where I see the incoherence and the phase shift asymmetry. So, sorry, I didn't put that up, but yeah, the overall quantum state in this case is going to be this coherent superposition, whereas here it's going to be this mixture, but there's no contradiction because we understand now that these two people who were disputing,
representing these two
positions, were always imagining that, a different thing. They were describing their quantum system relative to different reference frames. They were essentially disagreeing on the placement of the cut, and that's where the appearance of a contradiction came in. So when Molmer said, let's now model the atoms in the gain medium quantum mechanically and see what we get for the system, the mistake was saying, the thing that we should compare in this new placement of the cut to the state over here is the reduced density operator of S. That was the mistake. No, there's another Hilbert space that lies here, which is describing the relational degrees of freedom of R and S. And if you take the partial trace onto that relational degree of freedom, you'll find exactly the same state that you found here. And so you need to know how to make the comparison properly to see that you have satisfied the principle of cut motility. And that's what you essentially learn from this analysis, is how to make that comparison properly. Yes?
How do you motivate treating the reference frame quantum mechanically rather than just as a sort of classical system?
The principle of cut motility. If I think my physical theory is allowed to be applied to everything, then I've got these gyroscopes in my lab. They're made of atoms. I can assign a state in Hilbert space to them. Good?
Maybe.
All right, we're moving on. each of these little vignettes is, an hour-long talk on its own, so I don't expect you to be without questions concerning these things. But I kind of want to paint a picture of all the different places in which this principle shows up. So another thing it can do is that it can clarify what the correct definition of the free operations in certain resource theories are. So I want to give you an example of this, which is a kind of resource theory of coherence. So there's been a lot of work on resource theories of coherence in recent years. My former student Iman Marvin and I wrote a paper that distinguishes two kinds of coherence, speakable and unspeakable. I'm going to be telling you about speakable coherence, so I just want to tell you what that means. So if I have these two kinds of quantum states, I want to know, are they equivalent resources or not? it really matters what the 0, 1, and 2 states are. So if the 0, 1, and 2 states are eigenstates of some particular observable that I'm interested in, like maybe the number operator, then you know, under phase shifts, for example, they're going to behave very differently. So this one will pick up an e to the I phi phase shift. This guy will pick up an e to the I 2 phi under a phi phase shift. And so this one will be more sensitive to small phase shifts than this one will be. And so they're really different resources if what you're interested in having coherence for is, you know, doing phase estimation, right? If that's why coherence is a resource for you, then these are very different kinds of resources. But in other contexts, you might be interested in coherence because maybe you want to do quantum computation and you think coherences are important. And the numbers 0, 1, and 2 are just completely arbitrary labels for three states of your system, and they don't relate to any physical symmetries at all. Then it really shouldn't matter whether I give you this or this. They're completely equivalent. So the reason so the latter is the speakable coherence, and the first that I described was unspeakable. And the idea is just that certain kinds of degrees of freedom are non-fungible. Like it matters what system I use. If I want to send you a direction in space, we don't already share a reference frame, I need to send you an arrow that points in a direction in space, and I can't describe a direction in space to you if we don't already share a reference frame. Whereas if I just want to send you a message, I can use any system I like, as long as it can have some distinguishable properties. It doesn't matter which system I use. So speakable is the case where it's any system you like, and unspeakable is particular to a particular kind of degree of freedom. All right, so how do you come up? So the resource theory of unspeakable coherence is basically just the resource theory of asymmetry. But the resource theory of speakable coherence, there are various proposals. And the one that's received the most attention is this one by Baumgrass, Kramer, and Plenio. And I'm going to show you a slight generalization of it. Ultimately, it's going to this is going to be a kind of a liberal assumption that I'm going to allow them more operations for free than they actually describe in this paper. But it's the same spirit as what they're allowing. The idea is that they're incoherence preserving. That if I have a state which is the initial state is part of the set of incoherent states. So let's say this is the basis relative to which I'm judging coherence. Then I consider a map to be free in the free set if it takes it to another incoherent state. So any map that preserves the set of incoherent states is allowed for free in this resource theory. Okay? But you know, kind of like in entanglement theory, LOCC is free. Every resource theory, you have to specify what kinds of operations are free. So it turns out that this is equivalent to demanding that your map interacts with the dephasing map in this particular way. Okay, the alternative proposal, which we made, but also Gilad Gur and Eric Chitamber made, is that we should allow any map that is dephasing covariant, which means it commutes with the dephasing operation. So it doesn't matter whether I do the map, then dephase, or dephase and then do the map. So these are really distinct sets. The dephasing covariants are a strict subset of the incoherence preserving operations. So here's an example of a map which is incoherence preserving but not dephasing covariant. Why is it incoherence preserving?
Which is which?
The incoherence preserving, did you mean relative to the definitions?
Yes.
Okay, so the incoherence preserving was the first one. It just takes any incoherent state to an incoherent state. The dephasing covariant is just the one that commutes with the dephasing operation. Okay, so if I look at this map, it essentially measures in the plus minus basis and prepares 0 or 1 depending on the outcome. If rho started out, and here the basis that we have in mind relative to which we're evaluating coherence is the computation basis, 0, 1. So if rho starts out as a mixture in the computation basis, then when I measure plus or minus, I just get some probability, and what I'm left with is, again, an incoherent mixture of 0 and 1, so it preserves incoherence. But if I were to first dephase rho and ask, is that the same as, you know, doing the map and then dephasing, the answer is no. Because if I do the map and then dephase, it's like doing nothing, right? Because it's the final state is already in the 0, 1 basis. But sometimes dephasing before the map changes the action of the map. So, for example, if rho was the plus state, then you know the map itself just prepares 0. But if I were to dephase the plus phase first, it goes to the completely mixed state, and then the map becomes an equal mixture of 0 and 1. So for this map, it is not true that dephasing early gives the same effect as dephasing late. Okay. So here's the problem, that there are really different proposals in terms of what are the valid set of operations. But you can verify that they coincide on what the free states are. They're all the ones that are just mixtures of your preferred basis. And what the free unitaries are, they're ones that just take your free basis and maybe permute its elements and maybe add a phase factor, but nothing more. So you can just work out that both proposals, when particularized to states and unitaries, have this form. And now you realize that if you want cut motility, if you want to understand these free operations as kind of Steinspring dilations, you're going to have a problem, because the Steinspring dilation is only going to use states and unitaries, and you know they're the same for these two sets. So what you can show, actually, is that if you do implement a map in the following way, take your system, couple it to an ancilla that's prepared in some incoherent state, act a unitary on the two that is of this incoherent form, and then trace over some ancillary degrees of freedom, then you'll find that that map is dephasing covariant. Okay? That's not hard to show. And so what that means is that the incoherence-preserving operations can't always be realized by a Steinspring dilation that uses only incoherence-preserving resources. It's not a cut-motile set of free operations, and I would argue, therefore, it's a bad choice of the free operations. It's saying I can do something for free, which if I tried to model it just differently, suddenly it looks not free. That doesn't make sense. So I argue that is the principle of cut motility can sometimes tell you you've defined your resource theory in the wrong way, you know, your set of free operations. If you think, so there is a caveat here, if you think that the restriction that leads to your resource theory is one that is really universally applicable, that there isn't some sort of special kind of environment that you can prepare in coherent states and that you can then use. But if you really think that everything that I'm going to have access to should satisfy the same restriction, then this is not a consistent choice. Okay, the list goes on, but let me sort of wrap up this part. A nice example, which I won't say anything about, is how to solve Maxwell's Demon, the Maxwell-Demon challenge to the second law. If you look at Charlie Bennett's resolution of this, it's all about saying, hey, let's take the memory of the demon, let's treat it dynamically, let's ask, do we need work to make sure that the demon can do its job? Yes, to reset the memory of the demon requires work, and so if I can extract work from the demon, there's no contradiction. But it was thinking about treating the demon as a dynamical system that I think led to that realization. You can find another example in this talk of mine, which is a sort of challenge to Curie's principle, which I think ultimately gets resolved in the same way. Okay, so long list. I'll be interested in the discussions. Maybe if you guys have examples for other places where the cut motility principle has done some interesting work, I'm sure there's lots more. And I've got some ideas for other kind of conceptual issues where this trick might be useful. Okay, but let me try to get to foil theories and say, I don't know how much time I have, but what does it imply for how we should define my favorite kind of foil theory, which is these epistemically restricted classical theories? A brief overview of epistemically restricted classical theories. The idea is this. Start with a classical theory, like mechanics. Consider the statistical theory associated with that classical theory. So this is often called Lievel mechanics. So this is the theory that describes probability distributions over phase space, how those probability distributions evolve if the system undergoes some dynamics, what happens to those probability distributions if, for example, you measure some property of the system, you update your knowledge. That's in this theory. And then the theory I'm talking about is like this, but you add a restriction on what kinds of states of knowledge you can have about that dynamical system. And that restriction is called an epistemic restriction. So this is epistemically restricted Lievel mechanics. And what you can show is if you define the restriction in a particular way, which I'll mention in a moment, you can show that this theory is precisely equivalent in its operational predictions to a certain part of quantum mechanics, which is called the Clifford subtheory. And again, I'll talk more about that later. This is, you could also think of this as the Gaussian part of quantum mechanics. For example, all the pure states that have Gaussian profiles in their wave function. But you can do the same thing if my classical theory is a theory of classical bits, and their dynamics is described maybe by some circuit. Then I can also talk about the statistical theory. What do I know? I have some probability distribution over the string that the bits might be in, and how does that probability distribution update over time as it goes through the circuit? And then I can add an epistemic restriction. And if you do that in a particular way, you get my toy theory, and you can show that this is not equivalent to the Clifford subtheory for qubits. Let's also call this the stabilizer theory for qubits, but it's very close. It has a kind of isomorphism with that theory, but it's not strictly the same. You can do it for odd dimensional systems, like three-level systems, same sequence, and there you do get equality. So in these cases, you're reproducing a part of quantum theory. Here you're getting something that's a slight distortion relative to the quantum case. And these are foil theories in the sense that, you know, in these cases, this is a way the world could have been. It could have been not the full quantum theory, but rather this sub-theory of quantum theory. And here it's a foil theory in the sense that it's even different from a sub-theory of quantum theory. All right, so what is the restriction? Here's the basic idea, that quantumly, the situation in which a set of observables is jointly measurable is when they commute relative to the matrix commutator. We set up a condition that says a set of variables is jointly knowable if they commute relative to the Poisson bracket. Okay, so how does that work? Say I've got one of these continuous degrees of freedom, or many continuous degrees of freedom, or in the case of mechanics. So I've got n particles, for example, they each have a position, so my configuration space is r to the n. The phase space just has me associate a momentum with each of those particles. Think of that as some vector m, the point in phase space. So now I can define functionals on the phase space, just maps from the space space to the reals. And in particular, there's a functional associated with position, which just pulls out the position of the kth particles. This is the kth particle's position. The kth particle's momentum just pulls out the momentum of the kth particle in the space. And now I can define for any functionals a Poisson bracket in terms of these functionals by just say, take the partial derivatives of the functions f and g with respect to those position and momentum functionals, sum over the systems. That's the standard definition of Poisson bracket. Okay, so in these theories, we just consider these linear functionals. If I have two linear functionals like this, their Poisson bracket ends up just being the symplectic inner product of the vectors that are associated with those functionals. You can think of these vectors as living in a vector space as well, in a phase space as well. This is just a small detail, but the Poisson bracket is related to this symplectic inner product. Okay, here's the point, though, is that I could do this for other fields. I don't have to do it for the real field. I could do it for the integers mod d, for example. So now I just have discrete positions that are evaluated in Zd. The phase space is a Zd valued, both the position and the momentum are Zd valued. I can again define functionals, they map to Zd. I can again, now here's a little subtlety that I don't have derivatives anymore because these are not continuous variables, but nonetheless I can derive a form of Poisson bracket which involves finite differences. These guys just displace me by one unit in, for example, the xi direction in the phase space. And if you do that, you'll find that for these linear functionals, you get, again, exactly this symplectic inner product between the vectors that represent these things. So it's all precisely analogous to the continuous variable case. Good. So now you can say, relative to that Poisson bracket, what does it mean for a pair of observables to be canonically conjugate? It means that their commutator is one, so things like x1 and p1, those are conjugate. I can't know them jointly. x2 and p2, I can't know them jointly. X1 plus X2, global property of two systems, can't be known jointly with some local properties like P1. So these are all things that the restriction says you can't know. But examples of pairs of functions that do commute are like the position of the first particle and the position of the second. You can know those both jointly. Position of the first, momentum of the second, or difference in position, some momentum, that's fine too. It's Poisson bracket zero. These are all things I can know jointly. So this is the epistemic restriction. I just call it the principle of classical complementarity. You can only have knowledge of the values of some commuting set of canonical variables, and you're maximally ignorant otherwise. All right, so this is, let me skip this. This is what it looks like for the continuous variable case. You could know that the position and know nothing about the momentum, know the momentum, know nothing about the position, know some linear functional of the two, or you might know nothing at all, and it's just a uniform distribution. I'm not going to tell you anything about what you do for composite systems, but it's similar. This is what it looks like for these trits, right? So I have a trit phase space. The position and the momentum are three valued. I could know Q. I could know P, Q plus P, Q plus 2P. This is all modular arithmetic, modular 3. Or I could know nothing. These are all the only valid epistemic states for one system. And it's the same thing for these bits. All right, so this is the valid epistemic states for the toy theory. Okay, if you ask what are the valid reversible transformations in these theory, it just turns out to be those that preserve the Poisson bracket. Because after all, this is a classical theory. It has a phase space. We already know from classical mechanics what are the valid reversible transformations. They're Hamiltonian dynamics. They're ones that preserve the Poisson bracket. So we just take that on board. It's still a classical theory underlying it all. So these are the valid transformations. It means that if you have a point in phase space, which I think of as a vector in the phase space, I can act with a symplectic matrix on it, and I can also shift it in position and momentum. So this, for a matrix to be symplectic, it means it preserves the Poisson bracket, and this A is just some vector in the phase space. So, you know, in the continuous variable case, I can rotate in the phase space, I can displace, I can do combinations of these guys, they're all allowed. Here, for the bit case, these are all the different kinds of rotations, the different symplectic matrices. These are all the translations, like this is translating in position, this is translating in momentum, this is translating in both, and I can take combinations of them, and this is all of the reversible transformations. Good. Okay, so cut motility, we're back. I've told you the basic outline of these theories. So now you can ask the following question. What about the collapse rule? Let's say I do a measurement in one of these theories, and let's say I knew initially that the system B, its momentum was known, and therefore I knew nothing about its position. But I come along and I measure its position and I find some outcome. What should I assign as my state of knowledge of the final system? So you might think, well, if my knowledge about the momentum was not disturbed at all by this measurement, I would have known momentum initially. I just learned position, so I know everything now. I know both the position and the momentum. But that would be a problem because it would violate my epistemic restriction. The restriction says you can never know all that. So you could just say, well, if you take this restriction as an axiom, you can infer that this measurement must disturb the momentum. Otherwise, it would be violated. If you want it to be possible to repeat this measurement of position and find the same result, then the final state had better be have a fixed position. And the only way it can have a fixed position is if it has a distribution over all possible momenta, and therefore this must be the final epistemic state. And so we infer that measurement devices must randomize momentum in this theory. So now you can take the view that, oh, maybe this is just, you know, some stochastic objective randomness process that randomizes momentum. That's what this axiom commits us to. But you'd be mistaken. You can just ask, what happens if I move the cut? What happens if I say, let's not analyze this measurement as just an external intervention directly on the system, but we model it as the system interacting with some probe particle in a particular way, and then a measurement on that probe particle. So this is what happens. Suppose I make it a von Neumann measurement. So here it's classical, but this is the same sort of Hamiltonian von Neumann assumes. The idea is that it's a PQ coupling. So A is my probe particle, B is my system. This kind of PQ coupling says whatever the position of B is, remember that PA is the generator of translations. So even classically, a momentum in the Hamiltonian generates translations. So it says translate A by an amount that depends on the initial position of B. So the idea of this measurement is that I'm going to translate A by an amount that depends on the initial position of B. I'm going to measure the final position of A, and I'm also going to have known the initial position of A, and so I can infer how much it's been translated, and so I can infer the position of B. This is just a von Neumann measurement in a classical scenario. So obviously, if I assume cut motility, then system A is no exception. It satisfies the epistemic restriction. It has to start out in a state of well-defined position because I'm going to try to measure how much it's translated. If I knew nothing about its initial position, I couldn't figure that out. And if I commit myself to knowing its initial position, I must know nothing about its initial momentum. So that's a given for this measurement to work. Now here's the interesting thing. There's an action-reaction principle in classical mechanics which says that Q is the generator of momentum translation. And this coupling says that system B is going to be translated in momentum by an amount that's proportional to the momentum of system A initially. But the momentum of system A initially is totally unknown. So this says that system B is going to be translated in momentum by a totally unknown amount. And so what's going to happen is if you just tell me that you've implemented this interaction with this initial distribution, you're going to infer that the final state of B is just in some uniform distribution because you didn't know what its position was initially, and now you've just lost knowledge of what its momentum is at the final time because it's been translated by an unknown amount. And then finally, if you come along and you register the outcome of this measurement and you find that it's Q, well, that teaches you what the position of system B was. So then you can update your knowledge to say, well, I've lost track of what its momentum was, but I know its position. So I've now derived the rule that I told you had to be the right one according to the axiom. But I've derived it by applying the axiom to this other way of thinking about the measurement where I've moved the cut over and treated this guy dynamically. There's no stochastic probabilities here. There's no objective probability. The disturbance in momentum is entirely by virtue of my ignorance of the initial momentum of the probe particle. So I just that ignorance gets inherited in the final state of the system particle from my ignorance of the initial state of the probe particle. OK, so these epistemically restricted theories have this kind of cut motility in them. There's another place where cut motility shows up in these theories, which is if I look at this, the convex state space, right? So these are the possible point distributions. They just form a tetrahedron. The valid epistemic states are the ones that are, you know, halfway along each edge and the one in the middle. Those are the seven valid epistemic states. So this is what they look like if I remove those lines. And they're very analogous to the stabilizer states. And a question I often get is why not take your toy theory and convex close it, include all the states that are in this octahedron? Because then you're closer to the quantum set. The quantum set's the whole sphere. The octahedron obviously involves many more states than just the seven that you have. So why not do that? You'll get closer to quantum theory. Well, one answer is that these kinds of arbitrary mixtures, like maybe a point on this line, for example, it doesn't satisfy my epistemic restriction principle. Right, so you might say, well, I kind of like that axiom. But you know, maybe you say, well, that just change the axiom, makes the axiom about the pure states, and the axiom doesn't apply to mixed states, for example. Then you could have them. The real answer, I think, is that to do so would be to violate cut motility. Because if I want to imagine that I can prepare a mixture of these two guys, then I should be able to model the dice-throwing procedure and then the controlled operation, which looks at the outcome of the dice and does the appropriate preparation. So I should be able to model all of that using the resources of the theory. And when you ask, can you, the answer is no. You can't generate arbitrary probability distributions in this theory. You can't do arbitrary controls. And you cannot access any of the other points besides these seven. Yeah?
So just quickly, I guess here and in the Maxwell-Stieman example, you're not using the principle as it is, just in a very specific way. Namely, in the possibilities to do the cut,
yep.
I trust one possibility more, which is treating the device itself as below the cut, as a dynamical system. That's what I trust. Right? Like in the slide before, you worked out the interaction Hamiltonian, for
yep.
example.
Yes.
And that's a specific version where your measurement device is seen as a big system, a closed system. Right? So you say, let's work out that, and let's take that seriously. And like the naive modeling of the measurement, where I just say, oh, let's not learn this, yeah, that doesn't work. So it's like you trust one side more than the other. I think it's
well, hang on a sec. I mean, what I was proving there was consistency of the two predictions. So why would I have to rely on trusting one more than the other if they're consistent?
Well, yeah, but yeah, okay, maybe we can discuss it later.
Okay.
Because it was a bit of detail. But yeah, okay.
Just a little, I mean,
yeah.
I understand the point you want to make. I just would like to say that perhaps this is not the strongest example for that case, because at the beginning you said the principle of cut motility is kind of motivated by desire of having a kind of complete physical theory, a theory that is consistent enough. But here you're saying, well, in this case, the principle would prevent me from tossing a coin and doing things that like we know we can do. So in a sense, it's kind of is in a tension with this idea of kind of including in the theory the set of things that we want to describe.
Well, bear in mind, this is a foil theory. It's describing an alternative to the universe we live in. So
well,
if
yes.
taking the principle of cut motility teaches me that the only way to make this theory cut motile is if it doesn't have the full resources of probabilistic mixing that we have in our universe, I think that's good. It teaches me more about, you know, what this theory really is. Because to imagine, like, if to try to get more of what actually occurs in my universe, I add features to my theory that just make it radically fail to have cut motility,
yes.
I think that's a much worse project. Like, it's better to take a theory seriously on its own terms.
But it depends on what you want to do with the foil theory. I mean,
yes.
I would be tempted naturally to introduce in the foil theory, like, simple operations that we always do. Like tossing a coin allowed by the theory and doing conditional operations.
But wouldn't it trouble you that cut motility would then be failing in your theory?
Well, it would say that the theory itself is not very consistent. That's why I'm saying...
I know, and so to my mind, inconsistency of theories is something I'm trying to avoid at all costs. Like, that's sort of the worst thing, is to have a theory that's inconsistent.
I mean, that's not the main example I would bring in favor of this approach. I mean, I agree with the other ones, but in this one, it seems there is a tension between two very natural things that we want to have. And in a sense, I mean, it just says that this particular example wouldn't be like the best theory ever.
So. Fair enough. So I'm going to try to wrap up. Okay. So here's just a way of thinking about what defines an epistemically restricted theory. If you can do the similar thing about irreversible transformations, define them in terms of their dilation resources that are used in the theory. So you can resolve ambiguities about how to do certain things. What I just said can apply for these Clifford subtheories as well. So most of you probably know the definitions. You know, your evolutions are Clifford operations. Your preparations are of stabilizer states. You can trace over systems. And so you can say, well, in the Clifford theory, what kinds of CP maps am I allowed? One approach would be to say anything that can be Steinspring dilated using the resources of your Clifford subtheory. That's what you need to have cut motility. In particular, in the Clifford subtheory, I would say you don't have the octahedron. That's not the Clifford subtheory. The Clifford subtheory is, again, just the seven guys who are joint eigenstates of products of Pauli operators. It's exactly as it was. And that is why we can have this strict equality, because it's the same rules in both. We have cut motility on both sides. Let me try to make one last punchline and end. So this is very speculative, but there's this law. I'm wondering if cut motility might help us solve a problem that's bugged me for a long time about the connection between contextuality and computation. So in these two cases, the Clifford subtheory of quantum mechanics and the Clifford subtheory for Q-trits, they admit of non-contextual models in my generalized sense of non-contextuality. And the proof is very simple. These epistemically restricted classical theories are the non-contextual models of these quantum subtheories, right? So both these guys, clear, they admit a non-contextual model. But here we had this inequality, and so it's not so clear whether this thing here admits of a non-contextual model. It may not. And in fact, there seem to be explicit examples of contextuality in the Clifford subtheory of qubits, namely like the Perez-Merman proof of contextuality. You look at the Perez-Merman, it's all stabilizer measurements. So it seems like, oh yeah, that's Clifford stabilizer theory. And now here's the puzzle. Any computation within the Clifford subtheory of qubits is efficiently classically simulatable by the Gottesman-Knill theorem. And therefore, the apparent conclusion is that admitting a non-contextual model might be a sufficient condition for simulatability, but it's not a necessary condition. Because, you know, this Clifford subtheory for qubits admits of contextuality, and yet it's simulatable. So it seems like contextuality is not always a resource for computation, if this is true. And so this has bothered me and many other people, like Joel and other folks here, like Pierce, I guess, for a long time, because in many other respects, contextuality seems to be sort of generically the resource for quantum advantages. But cut motility makes me question this standard wisdom. So, and here's why. So Ravi Kunjwal and I have sort of worked out how to turn various proofs of contextuality into experiments that would test contextuality directly without any mention of quantum theory. And they tend to look like this. You do a set of preparations of a system which have some outcomes, and then a set of measurements. So T varies over the choice of measurement. Y is the outcome of the measurement. And these are the conditional probabilities here are the things that are constrained by our inequalities. So it's like a Bell test, but across time. And then you can do this with Perez-Merman. That's in this paper. And so you have 9 binary outcome sources. So you're preparing these different eigenspaces of this operator or different eigenspaces of this operator and meeting them with one of these measurements. And you can show that there's some inequality that's violated quantum mechanically. And now the point is that if you say this is what we mean by having contextuality, admitting of an experiment that would really violate some inequality, then you can ask, is this experiment something that can be done in the Clifford subtheory or not? And you don't have the resources to make, although each of the measurements in this Pres-Merman proof are a stabilizer, you need to make the choice of the measurement dependent on a setting variable. You need a controlled operation that toggles the choice of the stabilizer measurement you're doing. And that's something that you don't find in the Clifford subtheory. So from this perspective, the Clifford theory does not contain the resources to do these experiments that show that it's contextual. And so in this sense, it might be the case that the Clifford subtheory comes back really as non-contextual. But I'm not confident of that conclusion. It's just a maybe. And let me end there. Thanks.
The idea of the discussion session is that we have all the questions there. Or
Given the time, yes.
I think the homework is important. And I think we should have a lot of time for discussing this. Okay. And I guess we will do that discussion
in
the room after the coffee break.
At
12:30.
Right, but we go for coffee, and when we're done, we go to the lunch.
So we should say it
yes.
more or less. At
it's in principle, it's at 12.
We make it a bit early. Just
yes.
I have to do the location.
12:15.
Yeah, 12:15.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.